Vandasya Gananjana Salakaya Chaksur Undalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manovishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadam Ayam Dadati Swapadantikam Bandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Parakamalam Shri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Visakam Vitamscha Hey Krishna, Karna Sindo, Dinabando, Jagatpate, Kopesha, Kopika, Kanta, Radha, Kanta, Namostute, Tapta, Kanchana, Gorangi, Radhe, Brindavaneshri, Prishavana, Sutadevi, Pranamami, Hari, Priye, Vanchakapa, Trubhyascha, Kripa, Sinubhya, Vasha, Patitanam, Vaganevyo, Vaishnavevyo, Namo, Namaha, Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shri Vasudhi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 So thank you for coming. My name is Prahlad Ananda Swami and today is the auspicious appearance day of one of our most important personalities that we follow there in his footsteps and we worship him. His name is Lord Ramachandra. There's a little picture of him here, along with his associates known as Sita, Lakshman, and Hanuman. And today we're going to read one verse from the Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken by Lord Ramachandra in a different form, known as Lord Krishna. He spoke this Bhagavad Gita 5,000 years ago. And this explains something about the different appearances that Lord Krishna makes in this world. Sometimes we think, or there's some philosophers and some religionists who claim that God personally doesn't come to this world. But we understand that God can come. There's no one who's made a restriction. You know, God can't come here. There's no sign that we've seen so far. Although most people in the material world would rather that God wasn't here, because that's what the material world is all about. A place where everyone has come to forget about God. And when we hear the description of God in most religious philosophies, we can understand why people want to forget about God. In other words, God is usually depicted as some old man who more or less became senile because he's so old, and therefore he's committing so many mistakes. There's one priest, and he wrote a book, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. So his conclusion was that bad things happen to good people because although God is a nice person, but he's become old and senile, and therefore he can't keep things together like he used to. Therefore, sometimes bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people. But now they're having some meetings in the spiritual world, and they've decided that maybe God should retire soon, and one of the angels take over, so there's some hope for the future. God is sometimes depicted as an old man who's more or less trying to hold on to things, clutching the earth, but he just can't do what he used to do. But the conception of God given in the Vedic literature is very much different. That God is not an old man. That God is Naviyovanam Sha. It is said in the Brahma Samhita, Vedeshu Duralavam Adurlavam Atma Bhakto Advaitam Achutam Anadi Anantarupam Adyam Puranam Naviyovanam Cha Vedeshu Duralavam Adurlavam Atma Bhakto Govindam Adi Purusham Tamahang Vajami. That God, although He's the oldest of everyone, He's still the youngest. That the Supreme Personality of Godhead, He has many different aspects of His personality. According to Darwin, all of us have come from the apes. But that's not actually very reasonable, because if we examine our own ancestry, if we look back for our father and our mother and our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers, who here can say that they've traced their ancestry back and they've discovered that actually one of their ancestors was a monkey? Does anyone has discovered that? Looking through their family tree, you go through your album, there was great-grandfather, he was a general in the army. But here, there's great-great-grandmother. Wow, she looks a little strange. And grandfather looks a little strange too. What is he doing in that tree? Why didn't he shave? He doesn't look like he's ever shaved. What's that funny expression on his face? No, I don't think any of us have encountered that, that one of our great-great-great-grandmothers or grandfathers was a monkey. Now we can understand from the Brahma Samhita, Govindam Adi Purusham Tamahang Bhujami, that the original person from which everyone has come from is also a person. In other words, if we're a person, how is it that the original person wasn't a person? If we have certain qualities, we have certain likes and dislikes, how is it that the person from whom we're all coming from doesn't have likes and dislikes? If we say we have a father, so our father's not a person, or our grandfather wasn't a person, so where do we trace it back? And we find in our origin there was a non-person in our origin. So we can understand that actually the original person is a person just like we're a person, but he's an unlimited person. It is said, Aishvaryasya Samagrasya Viryasya Yashashastriyaha Jnana Vairagyas Chaiva Shanam Bhagahitinganaha. That God, or the original personality of Godhead, is a person like us, and he has certain qualities or opulences. According to Parasara Muni, there are six different opulences that everyone possesses to some degree, namely wealth and beauty and knowledge and strength and fame and renunciation. So all of us here have wealth to some degree. We may have some personal beauty or some learning. But who here can say that they have the most wealth or the most learning? But God is that person who, if we search out everyone in this universe or in many universes, then we'll find out the person who's the most beautiful, that's God. Or the person who has the most power, that's God. Or the most knowledge, that's God. So God has certain qualities, and He's called Krishna because He has such unlimited qualities that He becomes attractive to everyone. Everyone's attracted to some qualities. And God is that person who possesses all qualities to an unlimited extent, and therefore He becomes attractive to everyone. And sometimes Krishna comes, as He came 5,000 years ago, and He speaks a book such as Bhagavad Gita. And the proof that Krishna came 5,000 years ago is not that we have a picture of Him. We have pictures of Him. He was described by the sages, the persons who lived there. But that may not be, we may not accept the authority of the sages. For instance, nowadays, if we read the newspapers, people in general to some extent or to a large extent, accept the authority of the newspapers. Therefore, whatever they read in the newspapers, they think is true. And sometimes people accept the authority of their teachers or their parents. So we accept so many authorities. But because most of us are unfamiliar with the Vedic literature, when the Vedic literature describes about God coming and his activities, we may not have very much faith. But 5,000 years ago, Krishna came and spoke Bhagavad Gita, and all of us can read Bhagavad Gita, it's available, and see whether or not the person who spoke it was full of knowledge. Whether the knowledge, if God is actually full of knowledge, then whatever he speaks must be perfect. Perfect means there can't be any mundane mistakes. It can't be spoken by a person with imperfect senses. He can't be under illusion. And the idea of his writing the book can't be to cheat us. If we examine practically any other literature, then we'll find that whatever books we've read, they always have to be updated. There always has to be a revived edition of it. Something has to change as new discoveries are made, so the old literature becomes antiquated. But Bhagavad Gita has been existing, at least in its written form, since 5,000 years ago, and there has been no need to change even one word in the Bhagavad Gita. For instance, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that everyone has a body that's changing. So who here can deny that their body is changing? Could anyone say here they have the exact same body they had 15, 20 years ago? There's no difference at all. Every wrinkle I have on my face, every dot I have is exactly the same wrinkle and dot I had 20 years ago. Now everyone has a body that's changing, but Krishna says within every body, not only human beings, but also in the other species of life, there exists a living entity who's aware of all these different changes. Not only the gross body, but of our moods that we have, of our conceptions of life. All these things are changing constantly. But we, the person who's perceiving all these things, we're not changing. Therefore, we ourselves within the body, we're the soul, the eternal living being within the body, and the body that we're now misidentifying ourselves with is simply a temporary covering over ourselves, grossly and subtly. And on that basis of that philosophy, Krishna goes on to explain what is reality. Bhagavad Gita is not a religious dogma meant to convince people to change from one religion to the next so that we can have more followers than everyone. No, Bhagavad Gita is a science of becoming aware of things as they actually are. Of course, when it talks about things such as incarnations of God, we may be skeptical because we have no experience of incarnations of God. And even if someone claims to be an incarnation of God, they can hardly do anything more than what an ordinary person can do. Someone claims to be an incarnation of God because they can produce some ashes from their hand. Of course, any one of us, if we take a piece of paper and light it and wait for a little while, as the paper burns down, we'll see so many ashes on the floor. And in other words, any one of us can produce some ashes. It's not a very powerful display of opulence. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Gamavi Shechabhutani Daryamaham Oshaja Pushnami Chosadi Sarva Samobhutvarasatmikaha. That I become the moon and thereby supply the juice of life to all vegetables. I enter into the planets and by my energy they stay in their orbits. In other words, with a little common sense and a little observation, we can see that in this universe, the sun is arising at its appointed time. The sun goes down at its appointed time. Appointed means that we can perceive that there's an absolute regularity in the movements of this most enormous planet called the sun. Whether we take this Earth planet as enormous or we take the sun as enormous, still somehow or another, there's an exact relationship between the sun and the earth planet. And not only the sun and the earth planet, but the earth planet, all these different planets are all set on their orbits, in exact orbits, so much so that we create watches and clocks to try to measure the exactitude of the movements of these enormous planets within the sky. So if we give credit to a scientist who makes one watch because it's so, we think it's so precise, what to speak of the scientist who's created the biggest clock called the universe. Unfortunately, in modern society, the only thing we can say is that he's dead. Poor God, he created this wonderful clock called the universe, and then he died. It was such a big effort for him. He died out of remorse because no one would recognize him. He was the unknown creator. No, actually, if we go to a doctor and we ask the doctor to take our pulse, and he takes our pulse and he says it's normal. He takes our heartbeat, he says it's normal. He does a brain scan on us and he says it's normal. He goes through all the different tests and he says it's all normal. And then we ask the doctor, my dear doctor, what do you think? And he said, well, I'm sorry to tell you, my dear patient, but I think you're dead. So similarly, in every aspect, whether we look at our own bodies, the wonderful creation of this body, or all the bodies, that we eat food, and without any scientists helping us, the food is assimilated, it's the unnecessary parts are eliminated. In other words, there is a wonderful arrangement, so many wonderful arrangements within this world that even our most advanced scientists can't even begin to conceive how such an arrangement could be made. The scientists claim that life comes from matter, but if they can actually demonstrate it, then we can give them some credit for their theory. If life is actually coming from matter, then why don't they create life from matter? Why don't they create one blade of grass? They can analyze, for instance, a chicken egg. It's simply some yellow chemicals and white chemicals. So why doesn't the scientist mix together some white chemical and yellow chemical, put it in some plastic covering, and then sit on it? And wait for the egg, wait for a chicken to come out. But although they claim that they have so much advanced knowledge, still, even the things that a chicken can do, they can't do. Therefore, we take these chicken as a much more advanced scientist. Because the chicken can actually create life. So here we're claiming that Krishna spoke this book called Bhagavad Gita, and he talks about so many things. So it is not that we're simply trying to put forward some philosophy and asking people to blindly accept it. And if you blindly accept it, the symptom is that your hair comes out, your hair falls out of your head, you start dressing a little bit more strangely than everyone else. And this way your life becomes subservient to some kind of mystical or esoteric book that was written 5,000 years ago that no one really believes but many people follow. Now, if we read Bhagavad Gita, we can judge for ourselves whether or not it makes sense, although it's talking about many things beyond our present conceptions and perhaps some things beyond our present ability to perceive. Still, if we use our intelligence and examine it logically, without bias, without prejudice, then we'll see it actually makes a lot of sense. And that is practical, inasmuch as we ourselves, we have a ability in this human form of life especially to come to a higher platform of consciousness where our problems that we face presently can be eliminated or at least forgotten about. Forgotten about in this sense is that as spiritual souls who are not factually affected by this body, although we perceive the body, it's not that we're unaware of the body, and therefore the different states of the body, such as happiness and distress, are certainly perceived by us. But we ourselves have had so many bodies which were so-called happy and so-called distress. Perception is real. It's not that we deny the perception. But it's the body that's giving us the perception. By nature, the soul, ourselves, we're not subjected to such temporary experiences of happiness and distress, relative happiness and relative distress. That we have another existence where we can be perpetually happy. But in order to qualify ourselves for that perpetual happiness, we have to come to a factual stage of awareness, of knowledge. So Bhagavad Gita is meant to assist us coming to that platform, and the method of doing that is to use our intelligence. It is not meant to dull our intelligence so that we become simply, as in America they have this a monkey on a stick, that when you become a slave of the master, then there's monkeys, the organ grinder is grinding the organ, and the little monkey goes out with a little cup and asks for donations. And people think, oh, little monkey, why not give him a donation? But the master came out and asked for a donation, and we think, well, here's the master. He has more money than I do. Why don't I ask him for a donation? But because the monkey's coming, you know, therefore give him some money, and the monkey brings it back to the master, and the master takes all the money, and if the monkey's lucky, gives him half a banana. So that's not the conception of why Krishna came 5,000 years ago in order to speak the Bhagavad Gita, or that's not the conception that Srila Prabhupada formed the society to distribute Bhagavad Gita because we need more monkeys on a stick to collect donations. Now actually this Bhagavad Gita is factual knowledge meant to elevate us to a platform of awareness where we can actually experience transcendental happiness. Transcendental happiness means different from material happiness in that it's unlimitedly more intense, more pleasurable, and free from all kinds of material distresses, not mixed up with anxiety and fear and temporality, but goes on perpetually increasing more and more. So here in this fourth chapter, Krishna talks about his coming himself personally. It is not that God is simply watching from a cloud, you know, seeing what's going on and noting it all down or typing it into his, you know, newest computer. And then when you leave your body, then he takes you and types you into the computer and then sees what your past sinful or pious activities and then decides whether to throw you to hell or give you a harp and horn and let you play it for, you know, eternity. So this is not, God is actually a person, he's very much concerned, therefore why shouldn't he come? Even an ordinary king, if he's concerned about what's going on in the prison, he sometimes may come and do a survey, see what's going on. So Krishna also comes, and he explains this in the Bhagavad Gita in this particular verse, which I'll read. Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam dharmasya tadatmanam shijamyaham. So this is Sanskrit, and there's a translation. Whatever and wherever there is decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. So this is the purport by our founder Acharya, His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The word Shijami is significant here. Shijami cannot be used in the sense of creation, because according to the previous verse, there is no creation of the Lord's form or body, since all the forms are eternally existent. Therefore, Shijami means that the Lord manifests himself as he is. Although the Lord appears on schedule, namely at the end of the Dwarpa Yuga of the 28th millennium, of the 7th Manu and one day of Brahma, he has no obligation to adhere to such rules and regulations, because he is completely free to act in many ways at his will. He therefore appears by his own will whenever there is a predominance of irreligiosity and a disappearance of true religion. Principles of religion are laid down in the Vedas, and any discrepancy in the matter properly executing the rules of the Vedas makes one irreligious. In the Bhagavatam it is stated that such principles are the laws of the Lord, Only the Lord can manufacture a system of religion. The Vedas are also accepted as originally spoken by the Lord Himself to Brahma from within His heart. Therefore, the principles of Dharma religion are the direct orders of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Dharmam tu Sakshat Bhagavat Pranitam. These principles are clearly indicated throughout the Bhagavad Gita. The purpose of the Vedas is to establish such principles under the order of the Supreme Lord, and the Lord directly orders at the end of the Gita that the highest principle of religion is to surrender unto Him only and nothing more. The Vedic principles push one towards complete surrender unto Him, and whenever such principles are disturbed by the demoniac, the Lord appears. From the Bhagavatam we understand that Lord Buddha is the incarnation of Krishna, who appeared when materialism was rampant and materialists were using the pretext of the authority of the Vedas. Although there were certain restrictive rules and regulations regarding animal sacrifice for particular purposes in the Vedas, people of demoniac tendency still took to animal sacrifice without reference to the Vedic principles. Lord Buddha appeared to stop this nonsense and to establish the Vedic principles of nonviolence. Therefore, each and every avatar incarnation of the Lord has a particular mission, and they are all described in the revealed scriptures. No one should be accepted as an avatar unless he is referred to by the scriptures. It is not a fact that the Lord appears only on Indian soil. He can manifest himself anywhere and everywhere, and whenever he desires to appear. In each and every incarnation, he speaks as much about religion as can be understood by the particular people under their particular circumstances. For the mission is the same, to lead people to God consciousness and obedience to the principles of religion. Sometimes he descends personally, and sometimes he sends his bona fide representative in the form of his son or a servant or himself in some disguised form. The principles of the Bhagavad Gita were spoken to Arjuna, and for that matter to other highly elevated persons, because he is highly advanced compared to ordinary persons in other parts of the world. 2 + 2 = 4 is a mathematical principle that is true both in the beginners arithmetic class and in the advanced class as well. Still, there are higher and lower mathematics. In all incarnations of the Lord, therefore, the same principles are taught, but they appear to be higher and lower in varied circumstances. The higher principles of religion begin with the acceptance of the four orders and the four statuses of social life, as will be explained later. The whole purpose of the mission of incarnations is to arouse Krishna consciousness everywhere. Such consciousness is manifest and non-manifest only under different circumstances. Here it talks about the Vedas. So it is not the Vedas as some sectarian book of knowledge. The Vedas are knowledge. As I mentioned, that we are spiritual beings. Being spiritual beings, therefore, we have to live according to that philosophy. That's called spiritual life. Not only we're spiritual beings, but the cows, the birds, the plants, every living entity is a spiritual being within a material body. So the Vedas describe that philosophy and how to live according to that philosophy. All the rules and regulations of the Vedas are meant for different persons so that they can live in such a way as to come to realize that philosophy. And the other philosophy is that there is a person who's the Supreme Person and that we're all His servants. So that's the Vedas. Indeed, any bona fide system religion, as mentioned here, whether it be the system of Christianity or Mohammedanism or even Buddhism, which is based upon that philosophy, is also considered valid. Today we're celebrating the appearance day of one incarnation. His name is Lord Ramachandra. He appeared in a different epoch. That epoch was known as Treta Yuga. It is not that things are always the same in this material world. Even in the last 50 years, since I've been on this planet, things have changed drastically. Believe it or not, previously people didn't have computers. Not only they didn't have computers, but there was actually in prehistoric times, they didn't even have a television, as hard as it is to believe. And there was even a time, practically speaking, not completely in remote history, even after the dinosaurs, when people didn't even have cars. How horrible. How did they move? How do they get to one place to another without a car? That society has drastically changed, even within the past 50 years, and it's continuing to change, not all in all aspects for the better. And we can imagine that 1,000 years ago, or even 5 million years ago, of course, modern scientists, they claim that only the dinosaurs were here millions of years ago. But we have some scientists who've done research in previous scientific literature written in the 19th century. And during that time, there are many scientists who found things which were called anomalous. Anomalous means that they don't fit into the present conception of human civilization. According to this scientific data, that people have found things underneath the earth, in strata of the earth, which is millions of years old, and they found not only human skeletons, but also different types of implements, like coins and pottery with designs on it, in strata of the rock strata, which is supposed to be reserved for the dinosaurs. Somehow or another, the people got in there and died. Although it says dinosaurs only, everyone else keep out. But somehow or another, people didn't keep out. Although this seems extraordinary, then why don't the scientists report it? Why did they not report it? Well, that's because maybe the scientists are not perfect. For different reasons, maybe the scientists don't like to present anomalous evidence because it doesn't fit their theory or the theory of the previous authorities that they've accepted. In any case, these things are factual, that there is anomalous evidence which demonstrate the existence of previous civilizations not only thousands of years ago, but even millions or even billions of years ago. Treta Yuga, the epoch before this Yuga, according to the Vedas, is called Dwarpa Yuga. We've been in Kali Yuga for around 5,000 years, and the previous age, Dwarpa Yuga, lasts around 1,300,000 years, and the area 700,000 years, actually. This lasts for 327,000 years. The previous epoca is around twice as much, around 700,000 years. And before that, there was an epoca called Treta Yuga. So Lord Ramachandra appeared in that yuga, and he's glorified in one book called the Brahma Samhita Ramadi Murti Shu Kala Niyateshtan Nanavataram Akarod Bhuvaneshu Kintu Krishna Swayam Sambhava Paramat Pumanyo Govindam Adi Purushang Tamahang Vajami. Krishna is coming in so many different varied incarnations. Just like here, Krishna has advented himself in the form of Gornitai, just suitable for this particular age called Kali Yuga that we're living in. Kali Yuga, we have no such ability to meditate or to perform sacrifices or even to worship the deity in the temple. Therefore, Lord Chaitanya has come with a very simple process that everyone can try out and see what the effect is, namely this chanting of Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. By the simply chanting, we can come to the perfection of life. But in Treta Yuga, the times were different, and so Lord Krishna came in a different incarnation. In that age, there are many people many living entities who were of a different nature, much more powerful than the present people of today's age. And therefore, Lord Ramachandra came in order to establish some order within society, and at the same time to show his pastimes as a perfect king. Krishna comes sometimes in order to show us how to act perfectly in different situations. Because unless we have a perfect leader, then it's very hard for the followers to make any substantial progress. In order to show us how to live in the material world happily and peacefully so that we can progress towards the spiritual goal of life, So he's come as Lord Ramachandra to show us how to be a perfect ruler. Presently in modern society, the rulers are more or less imperfect, therefore the citizens are full of anxiety. Education means education, how to make money in modern society, and how to make money, the only thing available is how to utilize it for sense gratification. The leaders themselves, they don't know any other purpose of life, therefore neither they know how the material world works, nor they themselves know how to escape the problems of material existence. One time one of our devotees was running for mayor of Atlanta in America, that's in Georgia. And during the campaign, there were some speeches, and during one debate, the person who won the position of being the mayor in Atlanta that year, he gave a speech. And then our devotee, he stood up and said, this person, he's running to become the mayor of Atlanta, and he says he's going to protect the citizens, make you all peaceful and happy. But we've seen that during the debate, he's been constantly smoking cigarettes. So everyone here in Atlanta knows that cigarette smoking is dangerous to your health. It says that on every cigarette package, cigarettes. But he himself, he can't even protect his own self from smoking cigarettes. So how can we expect he's going to be able to protect the citizens? If our leaders don't know what is reality, they can't even figure out the difference between themselves and their body, they can't stop themselves from engaging activities which are detrimental to themselves, they can't stop detrimental activities from happening to others, then they're not ideal leaders. But Lord Ramachandra, even if we hear about it from a theoretical point of view, we can understand how ideal a leader he was. So this is a story about Lord Ramachandra, one of the incarnations, and this is written by one of our devotees named Krishna Dharma Prabhu, and this is a summary of the Ramayana. Actually, the Ramayana is a very long book, much longer than this particular summary, but I'll read from chapter 5, entitled The Crooked Advice for Queen Kaikeyi. The aging Dasarath, thinking of his retirement, Dasarath was the father. Lord Ramachandra accepted Dasarath as his father when he appeared. Gradually entrusted more and more of the state affairs to Lord Ram and Lakshman. These two princes, along with their wives, served the king in every way. They were always thinking of the welfare of the people. Everyone became pleased with their disposition and conduct. They were gentle and kind, but firm and strict when necessary. They demonstrated complete mastery of the military arts, and having slain the powerful Rakshasas, even while boys, were respected as great heroes. So here's a description of Lord Ramachandra's qualities. That he wasn't simply elected as king, or wasn't that he was part of a dynasty, and therefore it didn't matter what kind of prince he was, that he was the next person on the throne, therefore he became the king. And he became the subject matter not of the Ramayana, but of some kind of newspaper on the stands. I don't know if they have here, Sun Times or something, or the Starlit News, and all the gossip and scandals about his activities are written up for people to become interested in or abhorred by. No, he was actually a great personality with great qualities. So Lord Ram was especially dear to the king and the people. He was always tranquil and soft-spoken, not retorting even when someone spoke harshly to him. He recognized the smallest of services rendered and did not take to heart any wrongs against him. Doesn't sound like our modern-day kings or rulers. Ram had conquered anger and was full of compassion, making all arrangements to protect the people. He surrounded himself with intelligent advisors and never made a decision without due consultation. Despite his power and ability, he always remained humble, mild, and self-controlled. He was not influenced by envy or hatred, did not engage in frivolous talks, and always sought the good in others. Being free from sloth, he was ever vigilant to carry out his duties. These are just some of his qualities that he exhibited. Certainly we would like, if the person who is leading us or the persons who are leading us certainly had at least a few of these qualities. Maybe even one of the qualities would be nice, or half of a quality, or some percentage of one of the qualities. But I think most of us will agree that our present-day leadership all around the world, wherever we go, is not exactly overabundant in these qualities like humility and compassion and tolerance. Much differently, we find that is anyone who has these qualities will be considered unworthy of accepting the post of leadership in most of our countries around the world. He would be an impediment for the progress of the country. But Lord Ramachandra invented himself. He displayed these qualities. And the idea is, Yadyad Acharya Shrestas Tattad Eve Tiro Janaha Siyat Pramanam Kurute Lokas Tad Anuvartate. That whatever a great person does, common men will follow in his footsteps. In other words, this Krishna consciousness movement is not presenting simply some idealistic, romantic, or esoteric philosophy or lifestyle that only some very unusual people can adopt for some reason known only to themselves. You know, they adopt this lifestyle running around the streets, selling these books, and, you know, some of them even wearing bed sheets. They couldn't even get it together to put on regular clothes. They jumped out of bed and wearing their nightgowns or running around the street, you know, trying to distribute these literatures, dancing up and down, not even aware, can't even get a job, just completely jumping up and down like crazy people on the street, banging on instruments. So this Krishna consciousness movement is not simply meant for that. The idea is that at least theoretically there is a philosophy that's given how human society can be organized so that people can actually live peacefully here. I was told when I was in if you go anywhere, I was told, you can ask people, older people, everyone tells you that when they were younger that they didn't even have to lock their doors at night. But nowadays, you can see that anywhere you go, you can't even get to people's doors. You have to go through some kind of, you know, you ring a doorbell, and then there's three cameras come and photograph you. Go through all the police records of 50 countries around the world. Check your fingerprints on the doorbell. Analyze your blood type, your iris, just to make sure that it all fits together. And then says, you know, what do you want? Well, I'm the milkman. Okay. Leave the milk here or someone will come and get it. And some robot comes out, gets the milk, analyzes the milk, makes sure it's actually milk and there's nothing added to it. So we can see that people's confidence has decreased greatly. That you can't even ring, you can't even, what to speak of, unlocked. You can't even see people's doors anymore. In other words, things are actually deteriorating. It is not that people feel more safe and secure, that they're more peaceful, free from anxiety. Anxiety has become a big killer amongst people. People are all suffering from anxiety. Even when Srila Prabhupada was here, he said that according to statistics, one person in three in America was a patient of a psychiatrist at some point in their lives. But there's a system of organizing society so that these things can be practically eliminated, even in the material world, if not greatly reduced. And the Vedic literature describes such a social system. And part of the social system is that there has to be leaders who are actually qualified. After all, here in the material world, our main problem is that everyone is trying to compete with each other to become the greatest. And that creates all kinds of conflicts and problems. And the less a person is in competition with others, less envious they are, then more qualified they should be to be a leader, because they could actually work for the benefit of others. If my only objective is to exploit others, and then I put them into leadership, and then I'm amazed that we put this person into leadership, his only objective is to exploit others, and what is he doing? We thought he'd be nice, but actually he's just doing what we thought he'd do. He's exploiting everyone. From their childhood, to exploit others, that the most intelligent person who can get the most money, he's the most respectable, who can get the most influence and power, and what do they utilize it for? To get more money and power. What are our multi-millionaires or billionaires doing? They're working hard so they can become more influential. Even they give their money away is simply to get some name and fame. The government was going to take it away anyhow, so they decided to utilize it in such a way as to get something from it. Therefore, if we want real leaders, they have to be trained in some other state of consciousness other than simply to get to become greedy and angry and lusty, with all the qualities that ordinary people have to some degree. It's not that our leaders should be those who have them to the highest degree. Real leaders who will actually help us in every respect are leaders who will become free from anger, lust, greed, envy, all the qualities that ordinary people have to some degree that create problems within our own lives and the lives of others. So if the leader is devoid of those qualities and people follow such a leader, then surely people will actually be making progress towards peace and harmony. Lord Ramachandra exhibited in his activities such leadership. And even if we don't have full faith that such a person existed, at least we can hear about how a leader should act. And that if such leadership can be created within society, then we can see that society will actually be progressive. Otherwise, we can see that modern leadership, if you have money, you can get them to do anything, practically speaking. They can give permission to the factories to put anything into the air that we have to breathe. It's not that we elect to breathe the air. And we don't really care what's in the air because it's free. No, how many of us want to breathe in carbon monoxide, breathe in the 5 million chemicals that they're producing in the factories? How many of us really are anxious? Oh, that smells great, I wonder what chemical that was. That's formaldehyde. That's what they put the dead bodies in. Wow, that's fantastic. What else are they? No, but we've elected these politicians, and their campaign was run by the factory owners and by the chemical producers. And naturally, they say, sure, go ahead. Put everything into the air. Let them all breathe to death, as far as we're concerned. As long as we can get some money, as long as you give us your contribution, we'll move out into the country. And you can take care of the people in the city. So such leadership, certainly is not beneficial for us. And whether they know it or not, it's not really beneficial for them either. Because the leader actually gets a proportion of the results of the activities within the society. Therefore, even theoretically, we should study books such as the Ramayana, Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, try to understand what the qualities of a leader are, because the citizens in modern society, they're supposed to elect the leaders. But if they don't know what the qualities of a leader are, who do they know who to elect? Maybe many of you don't even bother voting, because you know it's a waste of time. That whether you vote one cheater into office or another cheater into office, you get a cheater. Whether one person steals from you with a smile on his face or the other one looks a little bit more serious when he's doing it, it doesn't make a big difference. But the difference can be made if there's a class of people within society who know how society should ideally be run and how to make some progress towards that ideal. And Lord Ramachandra, his pastimes certainly show us what the ideal is and give us some direction how to go towards that ideal. So although we didn't talk very much about Lord Ramachandra, so we leave it up to you to find out more about him. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes.
Sometimes people say to me, why we use these things which are produced from the fabrics, like microphone, tape recorder, or cars, airplanes. Why we use this if we are preaching to live in harmony with nature? And
yes, that's a good question. Why are we using this microphone? Because if we want to be in harmony with nature, why don't we all just go to the countryside and live like the monkeys and find some tree or cave and chant Hare Krishna there? Why do we make our lives so complicated, you know, with these microphones and having these houses and so many different things? Because our philosophy is not to negate things, but to utilize them properly. Our philosophy is that everything here belongs to God. That God is a person, and He is the supreme owner of everything. Therefore, the actual use of everything is to utilize in His service, and His service in this age especially is to explain about Him, to give information about who we are, about what this world is, how it works, and about who the Supreme Person is, and what our relationship is with Him, and what His relationship is with us and the rest of the creation. Therefore, this microphone, its perfection is to be utilized in the service of its owner. And since Krishna is the owner, therefore we're utilizing in His service by talking about Him. That's its rightful position. Just like if I have a pen, then I should use the pen. If someone comes and takes my pen without asking me and starts writing, you know, bad things about me, then I won't be very happy that my pen is being misused like that. So similarly, the material energy which belongs to God, if it's misused in something other than God's service, then it's not very beneficial for anyone. So we're taking the energy that's been created with the intelligence and with the help of God, and we're utilizing in God's service, and that's the actual purpose of this energy, whatever it may be. And on that basis, eventually, if enough people find out about it, then we may not need microphones, because everyone will already know the philosophy. And therefore, gradually, we're utilizing the current materialistic society's things that it has within it, whether cars or microphones or tape recorders, because they can be utilized in God's service. But if people take this philosophy seriously in the future, then maybe things will become more simplified. In any case, as Prabhupada writes in the Nectar of Devotion, in the introduction, we're not decrying these things, saying that they're unreal, because they already belong to God. We don't say that people have to live the same in a very austere way, that they can remain in their present positions with their present material comforts. But they should try to develop a sense of God consciousness, become aware of how this world is connected with God, and become a little appreciative of Him. If an ordinary person gives me, you know, 50 euros, then I become a little appreciative. But God has given us the sun, who's giving us unlimited heat and light since time immemorial, We don't give him any appreciation. If we hear this philosophy through this microphone and we develop a little appreciation for the person who is the most generous, who is most influential within our life, who is our best friend, then certainly it will be beneficial. And whatever sphere of life we're acting in now, whether we continue on, you know, in any occupation or in a particular family life, then that's all right. But if we develop a sense of God consciousness in that particular circumstance, then our lives will make progress towards perfection. Yes.
Can you explain more about the incarnation of Lord Krishna as Lord Buddha? What his purpose was?
Very simply, it's explained here. Lord, in the Vedas, there is some allowance for killing animals. Cows are never killed in the, according to the Vedic injunction, but lesser animals are sometimes killed by persons who can't eat anything else but animals, because they have no higher consciousness. So in order to help them progress towards a higher state of consciousness, there are some rules and regulations when animals can be sacrificed. But before the advent of Lord Buddha or during his time, that people were whimsically killing animals with no higher purpose, not following, just taking the Vedas as an excuse for animal sacrifices, but just devouring them indiscriminately and not really helping them progress towards a higher consciousness, but actually degrading themselves. So Lord Buddha seeing that, or Lord Krishna seeing that, he advented as Lord Buddha and preached the philosophy of ahimsa, or nonviolence, telling people that they should reject the Vedas, but instead they should simply practice nonviolence and a process of meditation to make themselves more peaceful. Because people are not, at that particular time, most people are not capable of understanding a higher philosophy because they were too sinful, they were too much absorbed in gratifying their senses. They wouldn't listen to anything else. But when Lord Buddha came, he told them to give up the Vedas so they could stop their sinful activities of utilizing the Vedas as a pretext for animal sacrifice. In other words, Krishna has a very long-term plan to help people, because after Lord Buddha came, then another incarnation named Sankaracharya came, an incarnation of Lord Shiva, and he taught people to reject Buddhism and to reestablish faith in the Vedas, but he also taught an impersonal philosophy, which didn't really disturb people's minds too much, trying to conceive of a personal God. But then later on, in the course of some actually hundreds and thousands of years, or at least hundreds of years, then different persons came and they gradually re-educated people so that they believed in God. Even Lord Jesus Christ came some hundreds of thousands of years ago and toward a philosophy of worshiping God as a person, so that people can be re-educated and rededicate their lives and existence toward God consciousness. So Lord Buddha is one of the many incarnations of God coming to gradually re-establish God consciousness within human society. Yes.
How to develop faith for Krishna.
Well, that's what this whole movement is about. The best way of developing faith for Krishna is, first of all, to hear about him, and then to utilize our reasoning, discrimination, intelligence, try to understand it to the best of our ability, and if something makes sense, then we can try it, practice it, and see what the results are. If what we practice, what we hear makes sense, and if we follow it and it gives us some higher experience, some greater happiness, greater sense of awareness, then we'll develop faith that this actually makes sense. And the person who's presenting it, and the person they're claiming is presenting everything from which it all comes from, Krishna, then we develop a little bit more faith in Krishna in that way. Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you very much. Grantharaj, Bhagavad Gita, Kijai. The appearance day of Lord Ramachandra, Kijai. Ram Nomi, Kijai. Gaur Premanande.